Hello and welcome to the PCOS Nutritionist Podcast. If we haven't met yet, then my name is Claire. I'm a registered nutritionist and I also hold a qualification in exercise science. That's my other degree, natural fertility education and functional medicine. And I have PCOS too, so I know how damn frustrating these symptoms can be. But I also know after 10 years or more of trial and error, how good it can be on the other side when most of those symptoms are in remission and I'm no longer without a period for 3 years, right? Like I have ovulated now every month for the last 5 years. I also know what it's like to not have to deal with acne or unexplained weight gain for the first time in my life, being able to maintain my weight without really thinking about it. And for you, those symptoms might be facial or body hair growth or hair loss. Fatigue was another one that I struggled with. And so many other things that people don't talk about, like blood sugar crashes and severe sugar cravings. Or maybe it's that feeling like you need to sleep forever to ever feel refreshed. So my philosophy is that PCOS is a condition that is a combination of your genetics and environment not playing nicely together. Now, PCOS is a genetically driven condition, right? We have the genes that predispose us to PCOS, but your genes don't determine your future or aren't guaranteed to determine your future. It's really a matter of the environment has to turn those genes on to make them present. So equally though, we can turn those genes off and not get those symptoms. So what I want to find out is what's affecting your, or what's driving your PCOS. So what systems in your body are not functioning optimally that are causing your body to have these symptoms? And there are a few things that the research shows can really drive this. The main one is blood sugar and our hormone insulin, which controls our blood sugar. The next most common is our stress hormones. The third most common is a thyroid condition and then chronic inflammation, or it can be some other causes as well, but those are really the main things. So for me, and when I work with my patients, the most important thing is to find out what's driving that for you, because then we can then have very specific lifestyle changes that are actually going to work. We're no longer just jumping from diet to diet, hoping that something will work, right? We know what the problem is and we can then put together a solution, right? It's like going to your mechanic and, you know, if you went to your mechanic and said, hey, my car's not starting, you know, if they said to you, we'll order a different motor. And you're like, sorry, excuse me? Like, have you even tried turning it on? Have you looked at it? Have you figured out what could be causing it? And they're like, no, we'll just buy a new motor and see if that works. And you're like, hold on, that's a really expensive way to go about fixing my car. You wouldn't accept that, right? You'd go, right, well, figure out what's going wrong. And that's the same thing as we need to do with our PCOS. We need to figure out first what's going wrong before we can put the right plan in place. Otherwise, we're just using a scattergun approach and hoping that something works. And I think this is something that we don't understand or haven't really thought about, is that changing our lifestyle, like slightly tweaking what we eat or maybe how we move or the vitamins and minerals in our body or how much we sleep, can have a dramatic impact on the way that our hormones work. But if we don't know what to focus on, then we're so scattered and we're just trying to do everything, which is just either not achievable or not sustainable. So this is the way that I work with you and helping you understand what are the most important things you should be doing. And that really is only 4 or 5 things. It's not changing your entire lifestyle and diet and getting you to cut out every possible food group under the sun or setting up with unrealistic training expectations where you have to exercise 4 hours a day. You don't have to do that and to see success and see results. And actually people that do tend to do those things like cutting out massive food groups or training 4 hours a day often find that their symptoms get worse because they're so tired and so grumpy that they can't stick with any changes. So I help you through my program, the PCOS Protocol, and this is something that's it's not just a PDF we send you. This is a program that I work with you on. So I'm there every week answering questions from you, doing live calls with you, trying to personalize and change things that you have the maximum effect while we understand what's driving this for you and what changes you need to make. So that's a bit about me and a bit about us. And let's get into the topic for today, though, because that is what you are here for. So welcome, Anna. Thank you so much for coming and seeing me here. It's so nice after all of our chats on the Q&As and the protocol and the Zoom to get a whole hour with you to talk about your story. So can you start from the beginning of your PCOS journey and tell you what's happened? Tell us what's happened to you.
Hello, Clay. It's really a pleasure to be here. It's really interesting because I don't remember when I was first diagnosed with PCOS. I remember when I went to have an ultrasound done a couple of years ago, and that's when I was told that I had PCO without, well, because there was that we needed to do the correlation with this with the clinical findings as well. And the sonographer said your ovaries are full of cysts, so you have PCO, you must have PCOS. You will have trouble to try and conceive. I remember that I left the room crying, and I called my husband, and that's when I first remember what happened, and in terms of what is to, you know, it was the first time I remember the word PCOS in my life. And it was really hard because I knew that PCOS had a correlation with difficulty in trying to conceive. So that's where I started to have some knowledge about it.
And what led you to go to the sonographer? What was it that was it? Were you already trying to conceive at that stage, or?
I wasn't, but I knew that I had long cycles and I had hirsutism, a lot of blemishes and everything. And I just thought, this is not right. There's something not right here. And then I went to the GP, and the GP said it might be PCOS. I was having my weight was increasing, was becoming an increase a problem as well. And he thought it would be a good thing to do to have an ultrasound done.
And when did your irregular cycle start? Do you remember ever having a regular cycle?
The cycles are mainly long. We used to be 60 days, 40 days, 50 days long. And that's what prompted me to go to the GP initially to have that checked.
Yeah. Because it's interesting for a lot of women because they don't really remember what their cycles were like when they were a teenager. They're like, oh, it's really hard to think back because, and that's natural because what is a normal cycle when you're 15, 16? Often for most girls, even without PCOS, they can be kind of irregular. Do you remember ever what your periods were like when you were a teenager?
It's very interesting because very recently my gynecologist asked me that question because she wanted to know my pattern, how long my pattern without any contraception, without any. So she wanted to know that, and I really don't remember. What I do remember is they were very long cycles. I used to have periods, but they used to be very, very, long cycles. That's what I can remember, really.
And were you like many of us that when you were a teenager, the recommendation was to go on birth control, or was that never proposed to you?
Yes, absolutely. I was on birth control for about 3 months, but I was so ill with it, with water retention, with sore breasts and everything. So I just stopped. I've just stopped and just realized that it wasn't a good thing for me. And I just came off of the birth control and tried a different types of contraception. Ended up staying with the copper coil, and that was the one that I got on a bit better.
The copper coil was brilliant for so many people because of that reason, that it does allow you to still ovulate because it doesn't have any hormones in it. Yeah. the way that it works is by actually cutting off the sperm's tail so they can't swim. That's how it works as a concept, in which I always think is hilarious. But it just means that we're not stopping any ovulation, not changing the way that your hormones work. We're literally just stopping the sperm from getting to the up and through your cervix to meet with your egg, which is great. Because it does allow us to still produce all of our normal hormones, our estrogen and progesterone, and also to potentially fix those while we're still on that contraceptive as well. It doesn't work for everybody. I noticed I got really bad anxiety on it, which had never been an issue for me before. But if it works for you, it is brilliant. And so when you went to got the sonographer and did the ultrasound scan, and he said, "I think you've got really polycystic ovaries." What was then your doctor or gynecologist? What was then their next steps or recommendations for you?
Well, for the next couple of years, I was really lost. I knew that I had PCOS. I had a couple of scans done at a later date, and I had immature follicles in my ovaries, about multiple immature follicles, about more than 10 in each ovary. But I really didn't.
I was going to say, I really like how you call them immature follicles. Now, this is something that if you're new to the podcast, new to learning about your PCOS, that what Anna just said is so good. So the cysts, the quote-unquote cysts on your ovaries, what they actually are immature follicles, or baby eggs that kind of, I like to think of them as baby eggs that when your body tries to ovulate and it can't, which happens when your cycles are 40, 50, 60, 70 days long, your body will go through multiple times or multiple attempts at ovulating. And because it can ovulate, those baby eggs will sort of stay, what I like to think of as, stuck on the ovary as these immature follicles, right? So that's actually what they are. They are not pathological cysts. They are not precancerous. There's nothing else apart from just baby eggs or immature follicles. So I love how you said that, and that's such a good thing to remind everyone as well. So then when they noticed this, what did they say?
So I was very lost for a couple of years with this diagnosis, and it was only when I realized that I wanted to conceive that I realized that really this was stopping me from going further and being able to have a baby. And when I went to my doctor said, "You need to lose some weight. Go away. Come back if you haven't fallen pregnant within a year or let's say he said a year or a year and a half or something like that." And that's what I was told. I was initially put on metformin as well to help me, because there's some studies where they show that metformin can help with PCOS, and so I was on metformin. It was only when I found out about the protocol, the PCOS protocol, and then gone into it and understood a bit more, I went to my GP and said, "Would you be able to do a panel test in terms of hormones, thyroid, and everything?" And he was happy to do it, but it was obviously to have a repeat thyroid and everything. He wouldn't issue a thyroid supplement because I had a subclinical hypothyroidism, and he wouldn't issue a levothyroxine or anything like that. So I had to go private to have that done and everything. And so that's when I first started to address the PCOS symptoms and the problems I had, I had as well.
And that's really interesting how you said that even though you had subclinical hypothyroidism, which means subclinical basically means all of the thyroid, if you get your thyroid tested, it will come back and it has a range on the lab result, right? And it will say, this is the normal range. For example, your thyroid stimulating hormone or TSH, the normal range might be between 0.5 and 5, right? And that's normal. And so if you're outside of that range, that would be you have clinical hypothyroidism. Whereas if you're at the upper end of that range, you would be, they would say, well, that's potentially subclinical. Yeah, it's not optimal, but it's not at the level where we would, you know, medicate. But the range is different for different stages of your life as well. So we know that during pregnancy, when you're trying to conceive, that range should be much smaller. And if you're working with a fertility specialist who knows more about this, then they might be more likely to medicate as opposed to your GP. And especially for you, Anna, because you're in the UK, right? In Kent?
Kent. Yeah.
And especially in the NHS in the UK, very much a general practitioner who you would see. And if they don't feel that they have the knowledge to adequately go, yes, you definitely should be on thyroid medication or levothyroxine, they'll probably choose not to treat because they're more sort of risk adverse and say, well, I'd rather do nothing because you're probably not going to die in the next 2 weeks. I'd rather do nothing than treat you and potentially over-treat you because I don't have the knowledge to know really what I should be doing there. So who did you, so you said you went private. Was that through private medical insurance or?
In the protocol, you suggest a place in London where I could go and have a try and attempt to have some macronized progesterone to help with my cycles and as well to treat the, I only found out that I could potentially have some thyroid problems when I did the thyroid questionnaire. And I really fit all the questions. I said, yeah, you know, that's how I got to understand that maybe I have some issues with thyroid. And that's how I said, I would like to be tested to find out whether I've got any issues with that. Mm-hmm. And actually, from all the articles I've read from that you suggested, there is, even if it's subclinical hypothyroidism, which is very marginally different from the reference figure, the reference interval, it can be enough to avoid and to make it difficult to fall pregnant.
Absolutely. And I definitely, if you want to know what these ranges are, they are in my book, Getting Pregnant with PCOS. So you can have a look in there because that's the fertility specific ranges as well. So have a look in there. But what we do in the protocol, what Anna was saying is that I get you to go through quite a lengthy questionnaire at the start. So I can actually pick out what might be driving your thyroid. And it can be a combination because we know for you, we'll talk about this in a minute, that your insulin was also too high and that was driving it. But then from there, I could see actually as well, that could be made worse or confounded by the fact that your thyroid might not be working properly. And there are lots of different symptoms, you know. So for example, the symptoms of hypothyroidism could be that you gain weight even when you're eating a low calorie diet, or you don't, you know, you eat the same, but yet you gain weight, right? That's one of the symptoms, but that can also be a symptom of PCOS. So a lot of these symptoms aren't specific, but when we group them together, that's when we can say, oh, wow, you really do have a lot of these symptoms. What were some of those symptoms for you, Anna?
So I can't remember exactly, but I know that when I did the questionnaire, at the end it says you should get a thyroid checked.
Yeah.
Because I fit into some in most of them.
Yeah.
So
a lot of the other symptoms I think we talked about with you were the fatigue, so just kind of like exhaustion. Feeling like you can never get enough sleep, so you're always tired no matter how much sleep you're getting. One really interesting symptom, which doesn't affect everybody, but it can affect some, is the thinning of the outer third of your eyebrow, which was another one for you, wasn't it? And I don't mean just like the normal tailing off of the eyebrow, but if you notice that there's some significant thinning there, that can be... Or thinning of your hair all over. So again, PCOS can cause hair loss, but we see a different pattern of hair loss with hypothyroidism. And the other ones can be brain fog. I think basically we just think about all of these symptoms are relevant to your metabolism or how your metabolism is functioning. And if we don't have enough thyroid hormone, so hypothyroidism means not enough thyroid hormone, then you're given that your thyroid is your main controller of your metabolism, then it's going to start to reduce these non-essential functions. So if you don't have enough thyroid hormone to for your metabolism to operate properly, then you're going to gain weight because your metabolism slowed down. You're going to start, your body's going to start prioritizing essential things and deprioritizing non-essential things like your hair, right? Like hair is just a dead mass of protein, right? It is not essential for survival. And so your less energy is going to go into maintaining your hair stores so that you can maintain other things like how fast your heart's beating and your lungs and your blood and things that are really important for you to survive. Another really common one is constipation. And this is because your thyroid is really important for making your like food move through your bowels. So if you your bowels have like thyroid lock and key mechanisms on it. So if your thyroid hormone comes along and fits into your bowel lock and key and then makes your bowels work properly. So if you don't have enough thyroid hormone, then your bowels won't work properly and you often get constipated. So again, you might not have all of those symptoms, but if you have, that's why it's sort of an art and a science from a clinician point of view, from my point of view, to look at those symptoms and say, yeah, you have enough for me to recommend that you go and get some testing done. Or actually, you don't. You know, it's probably not one of the main things. But one of the main things is if you have someone in your family that has hypothyroidism, then you're going to be genetically predisposed. So that would be if you had a family history of hypothyroidism and a couple of those symptoms, I would be saying absolutely go and get that tested. Did you have a family history of hypothyroidism?
No, I don't think I do, but from the questionnaire, you just really prompted me to get tested. Because really, I had subclinical hypothyroidism when I got tested. So that's how I got to get levothyroxine prescribed, and the levels are much better, even though I have to repeat that and everything. So, yeah.
And it's a really good thing to be aware of, is that you don't have to have a family history to be predisposed to it. And also some people just don't know if they've got a family history, right? Because often it might be your dad's sister and she might not have ever explained to you that she's on hypothyroidism, or maybe people haven't been diagnosed. So sometimes you might think, well, I don't have a family history, but actually there is. So now, as well as the thyroid, we also found out that your insulin wasn't working properly, right? And this was interesting for you because you then saw that so many of the symptoms that you'd been living with for many years were related to your blood sugar and your insulin. So insulin is your hormone that controls your blood sugar. So I know for you, sugar cravings were a big one, weren't they?
Yeah, really, really bad sugar cravings. But that improved massively with high protein intake at breakfast. Mm-hmm. So it really, really improved once I did that. But it was the sugar the roller coaster that I used, you know, I used to feel like completely mad, you know, going in chocolate or crisps or something like that, even in the middle of the night, because I used to have like hypoglycemia, and then I would wake up feeling completely wanting to eat anything that I've got my hands on. So it was, sugar cravings have been really, really hard, but improved really a lot.
And that's a really common thing. The interesting one is that you were waking up in the middle of the night, and I think this one's not spoken about as much. I don't know if we've spoken about this on the podcast before, but I speak about it in the protocol quite a bit, right? That this is a really common time when your blood sugar can drop quite suddenly, especially if you have this what's called reactive hypoglycemia. So your blood sugar goes high from high to very low. And then, so if your blood sugar is low, your body, that's not a good thing for our body, right? We want to get their blood sugar back up for survival. So if this happens in the middle of the night, then your body's going to release something called adrenaline, which I'm sure you've all heard of, which one thing adrenaline does is that it releases blood sugar into your bloodstream because it thinks you're going to have to run or jump or fight or flee to get away from a threat, a tiger or a tribe or a enemy or whatever it is. And so that can actually start to bring your blood sugar back up. But as well, you wake up because you have this massive shot of adrenaline and your body's like, what's happened? And so you wake up. And so I remember for you, you were waking up and you were like, oh my God, I have to just get some sugar. And that's a natural physiological response, right? Our bodies want to bring that blood sugar back up as soon as possible, as quickly as possible. And one of the best ways to do that is through sugar or refined carbohydrates, like same for you with like the crisps or other like refined carbohydrates. And I remember you were saying that you used to have to get your husband to like lock away the sweets.
Yeah, he still does that because I still wake up in the middle of the night wanting to eat anything, particularly sugar food, and that's still. I ask him to lock everything as well, so I don't have the temptation to go and eat some of those
things. I mean, it's a really good thing to just remind everyone as well, is that this journey from improving our PCOS symptoms isn't linear, right? It's not, all things do not resolve equally as fast. So your sugar cravings during the day have certainly resolved, right? Whereas sometimes, and especially during times of your cycle, you're still getting them in the evening or in the middle of the night. And that's something that we're still working on. But this is not some Disney fairy tale story that, you know, this was, you had these issues and then we, you know, found the problem with the insulin and the thyroid and then suddenly all of the issues resolved. That doesn't happen for most people. It's like, cool, some things improve, some things we need to work and change a little bit to make them improve still. But it's a journey and that can take months or years depending on who the person is. So for you, what have you noticed has really improved since you started working on your thyroid and your insulin?
Certainly, well, with reducing the coffee intake and dairy and gluten and everything, which I've learned from the protocol, I'm certainly less tired. The weight, especially around the middle, is decreasing as well. It's taking a little bit of time, but Well, one thing for sure, I've stopped using the scales, but what I try to do is just measure, just get a sense of how if I've lost weight by how the clothes fit, and but essentially, is I feel much more energized during the day. At night, still I wake up feeling hungry and everything, but I essentially feel that much more energized than compared to before.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important thing to talk about is that that the scales are a really bad measure of how your body is responding to changes, right? Because I remember you were so gutted when you jumped on the scales during the protocol, and even, you know, I do say to you guys to don't use them, but it's one of the things you have to experience for yourself sometimes before you can go, actually, okay, I get it now. I get why they're such a bad thing. And you hadn't lost any weight, even though you'd lost like 7 or 8 centimeters on your waist, your pants were feeling much looser, right? And you were like, so all of these signs are going in the right direction. So why haven't I lost any weight? And it can be a really, even though you saw the changes, it can be such a demoralizing thing.
Absolutely. And one of the things I also start doing was to fit my exercise routine into what stage of the cycle I'm at. Mm. For example, if I'm on the follicular phase or the ovulation, or I probably will do more depending on, for example, if I'm in a luteal phase, I won't do as much cardio. I'll do more stretching and yoga. And so this is, I've tried to incorporate that into my routine as well.
Yeah, that's really good. So what we're meaning by that is that in the stage from the first day of your period until about ovulation, which For some people can be about 14 days. For you, how long is that now, Anna, until you're kind of getting to ovulation?
I'm happy to say that now I've ovulated on day 11 because I'm on letrozole.
Amazing. Yeah.
On a progesterone. So I'm ovulating a bit early because I've had the trigger from the letrozole.
Yeah. So for you, so that would be, so yeah, day 11 to day 14 might be up to day 20 for some people, or if you've got longer cycles, then it could be longer. We do a whole, I've got a whole podcast on this that you can listen to, but it's basically until you ovulate. And then after you ovulate, you're in your luteal phase. And so in the first half, your follicular phase, you're producing a lot of estrogen. So about 100 times more hormones, more estrogen in the first half of your cycle compared to the second half. And that allows us to, you know, lift heavier, sprint faster, feel really good when we're training. Whereas in those weeks after, especially the week before our period, that's when our hormones are at their lowest, and therefore we might feel really tired. You know, if you're doing the same thing, maybe you're squatting 40 kilograms, which you could easily do in the first 2 weeks of your cycle, you now find that really difficult, if not completely unable to do that. And you might find that it takes you longer to recover from exercise, and just, yeah, generally feel really terrible. So what we're talking about is instead changing your routine. So especially that week before your period, you're doing a lot of stretching exercises or like lower intensity so that you're not, you're giving your body the rest it needs during that week. And then when your hormones are at their highest again in the week of your period, then you can get back into doing the more strength and power and speed type exercises.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that's really interesting that you, so have you found that really helpful for your, how you feel in exercise?
Absolutely, because I exercise according to my cycle. So I know exactly how I'm feeling and taking the most of it. And for example, as avoid, and now I understand that it's completely pointless to be doing cardio in when I'm in the, at the end of my, at the, you know, at certain stages of my cycle. So, so I know I can fit that those exercise into the cycle.
Yeah, totally. You're right. It's completely pointless because you're going to feel really terrible about yourself because you're like, oh, why can't I do this? Or even like, why have I got no motivation? And, you know, normally I'm really happy to go and do exercise, and why, you know, am I just lazy? Am I unfit? You know, all of these thoughts will start going through your head. Whereas if you know where you are, you can go, oh, it's all right. It's just the week before my period. That's fine. I'll just change the type of exercise and next week I'll be back to normal.
Yeah.
So you said that you're on letrozole now. So this is part of your fertility journey that you're going on. So tell us about your fertility journey so far.
So my fertility journey has been very, very hard because I had never thought that it was going to take me that long to fall pregnant. But in fact, it's taking a long, long time. It was interesting because my gynecologist, she said, when we were having a consultation, I've asked, do you think that in the middle of so many immature follicles, I would have like one egg that could be fertilized? And she said, in fact, women with PCOS, they have really high potential. We have a lot of potential in our ovaries because all those immature follicles can turn into an egg. Mm-hmm. Whereas, so that's why she feels that there's a lot of potential in a woman that has PCOS, rather compared to, you know, some woman that might not have that potential of her, you know.
Ovarian reserve, you're right. And that's why they use some terrible tests to do those, like in the UK it's called your fertility MOT and things like that, where they measure your FSH and AMH, or anti-mullerian hormone, to sort of try and get a gauge of how many eggs you have in your ovaries. And for people with PCOS, we have really high levels of AMH. So our ovarian reserve, or how many follicles there are there, is actually really high. And some research, now this is not like proven yet, but some research is pointing to the fact that maybe people with PCOS might have a extended fertility, you know, into their late 30s, 40s because of this. as, you know, compared to some other women as well. So yeah, I totally agree with her. It's just, we've got the eggs there. We just need the hormones to be working better to allow that egg to be released, right? To actually ovulate and have a good quality ovulation.
Absolutely. So it's been, you know, now is the time when I realized that, well, I have to sort out my PCOS and just reverse some of the symptoms to be able to fall pregnant. And I had a trial of macronized progesterone to see if I could to help that last part of the cycle. Mm-hmm. And now I'm on monletrozole, which I'm responding to. I didn't respond to 2.5 milligrams once a day, but I did respond to 2.5 twice a day, 12 hours apart. So right. which was really good. So you know, it has been really hard because I went to have a scan a couple of weeks ago, and the doctor said, you've got really a lot of cysts in your ovaries. So it was day 11 of my cycle when I was on 2.5 milligrams of letrozole, and I clearly realized that I hadn't responded, or I was going to ovulate later on the cycle.
Right. Yeah. 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 And that's often the case. It's just finding the right dose for you. And this is where letrozole can be a little bit of trial and error and actually getting that right dose. But it's great that they have got that right dose for you and now that you are responding, because it's highly likely that if you had done this prior to, you know, working on bringing your insulin down, that you might not have responded to that 2.5 twice a day. And this is what they call letrozole resistant, or if you're using Clomid resistant, where you just don't respond to really any amount of the drug, or it's not, you might respond once, but then not again. And the research is pretty clear that the most common reason for this is because if your insulin is still a bit high when you start using that. So that's why they'll often combine it with metformin, or, you know, metformin and also lifestyle changes like you've done. So the fact that you're responding is a really, really great sign.
Absolutely. And the myo-inositol Decaro that you suggested as well has been really great as well, has helped a lot as well, I feel.
What was that? The
myo-inositol and Decaro?
Yeah. Yeah, inositol is brilliant for helping improve insulin as well. So yeah, it's a great combination approach that you're using to do that. Yeah. And I mean, this has been the fertility journey for you, but we also know that a lot of the time, male partner's sperm is not optimal as well. And I know that this was not a issue for you, but more the hard thing was actually getting your husband to get a test, right? And this is something that I know many women struggle with is having those conversations and getting their partner on board to have a test done.
Absolutely. So I think that was it was so hard for my husband to understand that we needed to understand. I mean, I knew that I had PCOS and that was making it difficult for me to get full pregnant, but every specialist I went to, they've asked, what about the sperm testing? Have you had that checked? And Pedro would roll his eyes and everything, and we end up doing it, and at the end we just realized that, you know, you just confirmed that this everything was fine. Mm-hmm. We needed to have that checked.
Yeah, and I think this is hard for us females to understand, because our brain is normally, okay, I want to know if there's an issue and then I can fix it. Whereas a lot of males don't think that way. It's the, okay, well, I don't want to know that there's an issue, because that will be, that will make me feel like I'm not as much of a man, or that my, will really affect my confidence and really struggle with that, knowing what the outcome or that the outcome could not be ideal.
Absolutely.
How did you guys navigate through that? Because I know that that's an issue with so many people find.
Well, my husband was the one that decided, you know, we need to approach this. We need to find out whether the problem is coming from me as well, or if it's just purely PCOS and everything. So he was the one that ordered a test, the home kit, and ended up doing it without me knowing it. But then he then said, everything is fine. I think he was afraid that there might have been a problem there in terms of, but then, you know, and in the end, everything was fine, but we needed to know. And I think that's a lot out there. There's a lot, this is a common problem,
yeah.
Is facing the fear that, you know, people trying to get the sperm test checked and everything is really,
yeah,
it's really hard.
Really common fear. I think the home testing kits help a lot of people as well, because I think it's the, I mean, it's not like going and getting a blood test, right? Like the fact that you have to go in and actually masturbate to get the sperm is also like, it's, I mean, I imagine that is like really difficult. So being able to do that via home tests, which are available in many countries now, I think is really helpful in getting that test too. But to be able to, get through that, I think you're right that it's not something that we can, you know, badge them about. It's really, they have to hear it maybe from a professional who says, hey, we actually need your sperm test done, please, is probably the right way to go about it. And that you're not then having to get involved and being the one pressuring or badgering them to go and get it done. It's actually that they're being told by an independent professional, hey, this is what we need, and here's how you can go and, you know, go and do that. I think is a really, probably the best way. And then if they do have, it's the same thing to realize that as us with PCOS, that even if the sperm is not optimal, there's things we can do to help improve that. It doesn't mean that, oh, well, I now won't be able to father a child. Same thing with us with PCOS. It doesn't mean that we can never have, you know, get pregnant. It just means that we have to do some things to actually help our body to release an egg. And so there are many things we can do to improve the sperm parameters, whether that's by what we eat or simple things like not exposing the testes to heat, so wearing looser boxes, not putting laptops on your lap or devices near your testes, by not sitting in or spending a lot of time in hot water, like hot baths and spas and jacuzzis, etc. All of these things can really help improve sperm quality. And just like our eggs take 90 days to develop, sperm also takes a considerable amount of time to develop. So what your partner is doing now, or what the sperm that they're producing now, is a result of what they were doing 90 days ago. So it means that if we change our lifestyle, if they change their lifestyle, their sperm quality can improve within 3 months, and especially within around 3 to 6 months as well. So it's not something that takes years and years and years in many cases. And a lot of instances, I've seen sperm parameters improve dramatically within 3 to 6 months. But I mean, great that wasn't a thing for you guys, Anna. Mm-hmm. But if it was, it also is not the end of the world. And I think that's really important for them to understand that it doesn't mean it's not the end of the world. They can still improve those semen parameters as well.
It's easily manageable.
Yeah, absolutely. So anything else that you have found surprising in your journey of sort of improving your PCOS, or symptoms that you've really noticed have improved that you never thought were connected previously?
So one of the things I noticed a lot was dairy. Dairy mm-hmm. is something that has changed. I feel less bloated, with less blemishes. And dairy was really important to me. That was the coffee. Coffee is still something I'm working on to reduce my intake. But is also I don't, you know, I know that it has an impact on the more I drink, the heavier the impact is on my health. But I'm just trying to cut down on coffee as well.
Because how many cups did you drink previously?
Probably about 3 or 4 coffees, espressos a day.
Right, wow, yeah. So you were getting, what's that? An espresso is probably 180 milligrams of caffeine, so near on probably 600, 700 milligrams of caffeine a day. Yeah,
yes, which, well, drinking a lot of coffee a day.
Yeah, and what did you notice the impact of that? Now understanding what caffeine can do, and caffeine is not all bad, right? Like, different people can just tolerate different amounts, and that's depending on your genetics. So about 30% of people really struggle to break down caffeine and excrete it from their body. About 40% of people have just a normal ability to break that down, and about 30% of people have a really good ability to break that down and get rid of it, and it doesn't affect them too much. What were the symptoms that you were experiencing that you now know were related to caffeine intake?
I was constantly tired. Mm. I would have like an increase, a spike in adrenaline, but then it would fall down really dramatically, and I was having that a roller coaster as well of energy levels, and that's probably what I've noticed. When I started drinking one coffee a day, it really did improve, because my energy levels would stay pretty much stable throughout the day.
Yeah, and I think that's really, really interesting, is that while you might think that you need the caffeine to then improve the energy levels, it's a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? That if the reason we might be feeling really tired is because our body is having to deal with and excrete so much caffeine, and then it's having an impact on our sleep, whether we know that or not, we might just be getting less good deep sleep and REM sleep, and therefore we're feeling more tired and more brain foggy in the morning, therefore we need more caffeine. But it's actually, if we can sort of wean ourselves back to, as you said, one coffee as early as possible in the morning, then our body's not having to spend so much time getting rid of all of that caffeine, and therefore our energy levels and our sleep are so much better.
Yes.
Yeah, that's really, really interesting to see. So then, is there anything else that you would, you know, if you could look back 2 years ago to when you first sort of were made aware that you had PCOS, what would the advice that you would give yourself now, knowing what you know now?
I think what is so all the symptoms can be reversed if you, with lifestyle changes, with so that's what I would, instead of just going completely thinking, well, I'm not going to be able to fall pregnant or something like that. So I think the most important thing is just to realize that is food lifestyle changes with the adequate supplements and the adequate help, you can manage those symptoms and be able to, if your fertility is your goal, you'll be able to overcome that.
Absolutely. As I always say, the research is pretty clear. People with PCOS have no less children than those without, and on average, at least one of their pregnancies is a natural pregnancy. So all PCOS is just our hormones are a little bit out of whack. It's like an orchestra that hasn't been practicing properly, and they're all mistiming. You've got the trombone guy who's harping away when he shouldn't be, and so consequently the music doesn't sound very good. Whereas if we can help our body by improving those hormones through addressing the root cause, then our orchestra of hormones can work perfectly in time and allow our body to ovulate. And sometimes that might be with a medical intervention like letrozole as well, and that's perfectly fine. That's what they're there for, and they're really helpful. But it's when we help our body to work optimally, then the letrozole is going to be even more effective than what it would be if we didn't have that in the first place. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a really, really, really good advice. So thank you so much for joining me, Anna, and sharing your story. It is wonderful to have you here.
Thank you, Claire. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here.
So that's all for today. Remember that if you want personal help with your PCOS, then the best place for that is our PCOS protocol program. This is not some generic PDF that you get sent. This is the first week we identify what's driving your PCOS, and then you get given the most important changes for you. So, and I'm there with you the whole way, answering questions, being there with you weekly on the video calls, further personalizing this for you and identifying if there's anything else that might be going on for you. I mean, every week we talk with different women about different symptoms and you know, that might lead them to get an endometriosis diagnosis or find out that they've got small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. And that's what you can understand from hearing these stories from women, is about that often there's connecting issues that when we actually look at them holistically, we figure out what's actually happening for them. So if you want more information about that, then there is a link in the show notes, or you can head to thepcosnutritionist.com/thepcosprotocol, or just hit program from the main menu. And if you've got any questions, then please don't hesitate to email us. We're hello@thepcosnutritionist.com. Bye for now.
Now stand by for our disclaimer. The information contained in this podcast has been prepared for the purpose of providing information, including about the PCOS Nutritionist products and services, and is designed to support clients' overall wellness. It is not intended to provide medical advice or designed to rectify, treat, or cure any specific medical conditions or diseases. Nothing stated or shared in our podcast is intended to be and must not be taken to be medical advice. Please seek the advice of professionals as appropriate regarding the evaluation of any specific information, opinion, advice, or content contained in our podcast.